come on. I had a rough night, and I hate the Eagles, man.
To the Talka Talka podcast. I'm Patrick Santino, joined by...
And I'm Clifford Vickery.
Yeah, cool. All right, so Clifford told me he was a little bit tired tonight, so I'll have to bring the energy for us both.
I'm still awake.
Okay. Yeah.
How's your Halloween, Patrick?
Oh, that's pretty good. I was Bear Grylls.
Awesome. Did you just talk an accent all day?
No, couldn't do the accent, but the party I went to, I shut that thing down. I was the last one to leave.
Nice.
How about surviving. You? What'd you do?
Hazel and I were bats. So, I wore a cape to work.
Do you think people are going to care what we were for Halloween a month later from when this comes out?
Easily. This would be part of our personalities. Anyways.
Oh, that's cute. Okay. Yeah, so, all right. So for this episode, a little bit more laid back than probably the past two, just a fairly routine chapter. So anyways, topics for tonight. Bilbo's reunited with his friends. Bilbo, does he acquire a new status among them now? Then we'll have to talk about wargs and eagles as well. Two new creatures that we've met.
Sounds pretty exciting.
Indeed. Why don't you start us off?
Cliff's Notes, here we go. Chapter 6, Episode 6 of The Hobbit, Talka Talka Podcast. So, if you remember, at the very end of the last chapter, Bilbo escaped from the cave, from the mountains, the Misty Mountains. So, having just escaped by the hairs of his chinny-chin-chin, he's now free, but he's lost, and he's hungry, and he's tired. He starts working his way down the mountain, and eventually hears voices. He manages to sneak up on the dwarves and Gandalf with his magic ring, which he neglects to tell anyone about until he appears in the middle of their camp. The reunited group still is in danger, because they know the goblins will be after them sooner or later, so they quickly start making their way further downhill and away from the mountains. Just when they're planning to set up camp for the night, the howling of wolves sends them scrambling into the trees. Gandalf learns that these wolves intend to keep them surrounded until the goblins, who are occasionally allies of the wolves, arrive to capture the dwarves. Gandalf and Bilbo as well. Gandalf uses some fire to put up a fight, but the goblins get wise to the game pretty quickly and begin kindling fires below the trees where everyone's hiding. Just in the nick of time, Gandalf and everyone else is swept away by the Lord of the Eagles and his clan. They're flown to safety and eventually fed dinner atop the Eagle's mountain airy.
All right, Clifford. All right, nice job. So you sent me some questions before this that you'd have. Mm-hmm. I thought the one was fun. Why don't you just read it word for word what you said?
Patrick's making fun of me here because he thinks my question was goofy. I wrote, we got some context on the local geography and struggles, meaning men slowly moving up from the south, maybe returning or colonizing the woods, the goblins slowly taking over another pass from the mountains, intending to raid the men's villages and stop their advance. The eagles are neutral observers. To me, it felt like everything was geopolitical. And I wondered if Tolkien was making any parallels to westward expansion and manifest destiny, or maybe returning life to a sick land. If Patrick had any thoughts on this, is this just unique to the story? I will admit, maybe the analogy is far-fetched, but I was talking about, what I meant to say is, this whole chapter felt a lot more geopolitical to me than past ones. The last chapter, for example, was just Bilbo and Gollum going at it. So it was a very personal chapter. There's not a lot of outside things going on. This chapter seems to be all about these different groups and creatures and who's fighting with who and who's allied with who and who's controlling what land. And usually in these geopolitical struggles, you get parallels to like the ways that people take over territory and the ways that people view it. So, for example, Tolkien mentioned that men are slowly spreading northwards into previously unoccupied territory. The goblins and wargs were going to lead a raid against the men to kill them and push them back. And the eagles are sort of observing this whole thing. The goblins are also gaining new territory. And sometimes the gaining of territory is described like, Tolkien seemed to imply that the men were, it was like a good thing that they were expanding. They're like bringing liveliness and life back to an abandoned place. Whereas with the goblins, it feels like evil is spreading through the wild. Other instances, like the claiming of territory comes off as being like colonialist. So I just thought it was interesting. But Patrick, you can neglect to answer or pitch in any comments.
Well, I mean, I think it's in this area, you got goblins interested, you got wargs interested, you got eagles interested, and now they're saying men are moving up here.
Is this a particularly special place? It's like rich in resources or critical trade route or something. Why is everyone going after this territory?
I don't know. See, that's what interests me, and that's why I'm actually like even. That's why we're spending time on this question, is because I'm wondering what group of men is here, because this isn't really a spoiler, but just in Lord of the Rings, I mean, there's no mention or any idea or hint that any sort of men live here, and they're saying like these men.
And by here, we're talking about in between. We're talking east. Or am I getting confused?
Yep, east
of the Misty Mountains,
yep.
In between the Misty Mountains and the Lonely Mountain.
Well, really, in between the Misty Mountains and...
The river.
River Anduin, which is the big river in the area.
Which, if you remember from Lord of the Rings, that's the river that they...
No, we're not mentioning that, Clifford.
I'm just giving people some context.
Dude, no, I'm cutting this part out.
Okay.
So they said the men are... I don't know, I'm mostly just interested in the men, because, like, what group of men would live here? And so they said it's men from the south who are bold... And, of course, at this point, when Tolkien's writing this, he doesn't have any idea of any sort of groups of men that live south of here, whereas in Lord of the Rings, we know exactly what groups of men live south of here. But, sorry to anybody that doesn't understand this reference, but I guess I would just take a stab in the dark and say that these would be men of Rohan moving up here, and then I don't really understand why, but... The eagles said that they steal their sheep, which means that there's people here for shepherding. And then it seems like a pretty wooded area from everything I understood.
So maybe, I think they specifically said some of them were woodsmen.
Yeah. So maybe a logging kind of industry. Send some logs down a river or something, you know, for building houses. I don't know. That's my best guess. And then, of course, just like Lord of the Rings takes place 60 or 70 years later. So there's no mention at all of these people in this area or anything like it. So I kind of assume they actually died out or they just went back to wherever they were from.
So maybe the goblins eventually did succeed in raiding their villages and taking over.
That would make sense. I think that would be my guess, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I don't know what you're talking about with westward expansion and Manifest Destiny, but... I just mean
in the way that... In the way that, like, sometimes when people are talking about taking over land, there's a... you can look at it from either side of the story. Like, if you see that at westward expansion as colonialism and just sort of, like, a blatant disregard for people who were there before and there's a clear power struggle, or if you see it as kind of a God-given right to an area, or, like, it is the highest and best use for... a certain group to expand into a territory.
Well, that was the other thing, too. It's like, What are men doing living in tiny villages if they're going to get raided by goblins? Like, you know, if a goblin is going to come after me, it's like, okay, I'm not living here. That's fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, they said they came
out. That's what I mean. That's kind of how a lot of westward expansion happened, is like,
yeah,
a lot of like pioneers weren't necessarily like, life was not good on any sort of frontier. It typically isn't. Those people are kind of setting the groundwork and eventually building a population that'll make life better. But at the beginning, things suck.
Yeah, so...
Oh, here's another example for you. In the Silmarillion, when we hear about the elves spreading out across all of Middle-earth after they've come over from Valinor,
That
is described, I would say, in a generally wholesome way. Like, their populations are multiplying, and they're healthy and doing well, and they're like, covering this distant land. But when we hear about the goblins expanding or something like that, it sounds like evil empire taking over, consolidating control. It's like a very negative view of territorial colonization.
I don't know. I feel like the whole colonization thing, I would just say I've always been a city person, so I don't really understand how small towns function today or 200 years ago kind of thing.
Okay.
I don't know. All right.
Well, moving on. I had some thoughts about this reunion when Bilbo finally meets back up with the rest of the crew. A few things in here. So I noticed that when Bilbo's all alone and doesn't know where to go, he starts to consider going back into the mountain to look for his friends. And immediately, as soon as he thinks that, he comes across or he overhears the rest of the group. And it seems like to me like another instance of this divine luck.
Well, I don't know. Okay, so I'd say that's lucky. I mean, I'll give you that. But, you know, like the divine or fate or...
Right, I didn't say chance. Yeah. I didn't say chance.
Yeah, but no, but I see. I think it goes into that, like, you make your own good luck kind of thing. It's Bilbo had the noble idea. Uh-oh, my friends might still be in these tunnels. Fine. You know what? I'm invisible. I can be invisible, so I have an advantage going here. I'm going to go try to find them and help them.
Mm-hmm.
So he's rewarded again for his good intentions and good actions.
Maybe you could also see it as like not even necessarily a reward, but like it's like he has a will to find them. And the presence of the will to find him suddenly makes him able to see them or hear them.
Yeah, I like that, Clifford. I like that.
It's like he becomes conscious of it, yeah. And therefore it's part of his awareness.
Nice job. This is why you're my co-host, dude. Well, how did the dwarves think of him, though? What were they saying when Bilbo overheard him?
Well, they weren't speaking too highly of him. I mean, it's kind of a classic situation, I'd say, of the kid who gets picked on overhearing all the rest of the kids making fun of him at school.
Yeah.
Like, if he shows up when he's still invisible with the rest of the group and they're all complaining... Oh, no, you know, it wasn't my job to take care of Bilbo. It's not my fault. He can't run as fast.
And why were they picking on him, though?
Mostly just saying that he can't take care of himself, and we don't want to be responsible for going to look for him.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you read what they're saying, they kind of got a good point. I mean, Bilbo's been useless as far as they're concerned. I mean, he was just literally dead weight. Somebody had to literally carry him.
That's absolutely true.
But that said, you know, if I was Bilbo, it's like, oh, I wouldn't want to hear that, you know. and props to Gandalf for
saying, yeah, and Gandalf pushes back.
Yeah, Gandalf's pretty determined. Gandalf's like putting his foot down, like, no, I'm going back for this guy kind of thing.
Which sort of reinforces, throws us back to the beginning, right, where Gandalf, it seems a little bit random that Gandalf would pick Bilbo to be part of this expedition. When Bilbo and the dwarves don't know each other, Bilbo has no experience doing this. Gandalf knows Bilbo, but Bilbo doesn't know Gandalf that well. It's just sort of a weird mix, but clearly Gandalf has something in mind, right?
Yes, Gandalf's very wise.
Okay, so speaking of Gandalf being wise, Bilbo shows up in the group, appears magically as he takes off the ring, gives everyone a surprise, and receives a nice welcome. And he tells everybody what happened, and he doesn't say anything about the ring, which is how he appeared magically in the middle of their circle. Gandalf sees right through it and knows something else is going on, but doesn't say anything. First of all, why does Bilbo leave out the ring and not say anything about it? Is it starting to affect him at all? Is it just coincidence? And then what do we make of Gandalf kind of already understanding the situation?
All right, well, if you were Bilbo... Sorry, so we'll get to Gandalf in a second here. If you were Bilbo, okay, would you tell him that you had a ring?
I don't know.
I don't think I actually would, because I think I would play the same thing Bilbo's doing here. Because, mm-hmm, I mean, he's been useless up to this point. Now he impresses them all by showing up that he saved himself from these mountains. And he even got past, like, their lookout, who's... Balin has, like, a sharp eye, apparently, among them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, he's building up his street cred here with the dwarves. And it literally states this. I mean, there's the line, "It is a fact that Bilbo's reputation went up a very great deal with the dwarves after this." I mean, you know, narrator's explicitly saying it for us.
I guess my first thought would be, I probably wouldn't say anything offhand about it. But if I was pressed... Like, if someone was asking about it directly, I'd probably mention it unless I felt like I had a strong need to keep it a secret. Like, it seems like kind of a big deal to keep a secret at this point.
Yeah, and I thought the dwarves, I thought they were a little oblivious. Not super oblivious, but, like, slightly... Okay, you guys were just bashing on how much dead weight this guy was, and now all of a sudden... You're just like, "Whoa, man, he must be better than we thought." And it's like, well, why? Besides Gandalf, what word am I looking for?
Defending him?
Yeah, besides Gandalf defending him, like, what else do you have to actually go off of that, yeah, he could actually get out of these mountains? He did. I mean, he's physically there, so somehow he did it. But you really, dwarves, do you really think he did this just all by himself?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, and like we said, Gandalf, no. Gandalf sees right through that. And I mean, and now that's because Gandalf...
So you're saying that doesn't... Gandalf doesn't even have to have any sort of all-knowing... He doesn't have to have any sort of omniscience to understand it. You're saying it, if you're really paying attention, it's almost common sense that something has to have changed for Bilbo to suddenly be so stealthy and clever.
Well, here's the thing. Gandalf is not omniscient. I think he proved this later in the chapter because he's crapping his pants with, you know, sitting up in the tree with this fire coming up and these goblins down there. Like, he's like, I mean, it literally says he's fearful and frightful. And I mean, he's not invincible kind of thing, or like all knowing or all powerful. But that said, a wizard is not just some old man. At the very least, he's a very good judge of character, which had to have been in his decision to pick Bilbo originally. So he's sized Bilbo up for days and days on this trip, and you know, it just doesn't add up that Bilbo could get out of there by himself.
Do you think Gandalf knows anything about this ring or what it does, about its history?
I think we'll have to keep reading on that. I really don't know yet at this point. But, I mean, Bilbo said he had heard of magic rings and stuff, so if Bilbo's heard of it, Gandalf's heard of magic rings.
So there might be some mythology surrounding it, but it's not like there's just one ring.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we saw in the last chapter, magic rings are a slightly common thing. Very rare to find, but it's not like there's one ring. Yeah, so back to Bilbo, though. I don't know. For the rest of this chapter, though, after that, yeah, he's got the ring, and he literally now has the dwarves' respect. Like, the narrator explicitly tells us he's got the dwarves' respect now. So he's not down to his kind of wimpy self like he was at the beginning of the book here. But throughout the rest of this chapter, he is kind of a passenger again, in that, like, everything's kind of just happening around him, and he's just one of the group going through it.
Yeah, because I should say, at the beginning of the chapter, he seems transformed. But really, as we remember from talking about the hero's journey last time, he's basically just reaping the benefits of the transformation that he went through in the last chapter. But yeah, I totally agree. He goes back to feeling a little bit like dead weight when we get to the wolves.
Yeah.
And the Eagles.
But, well, so when we say dead weight, I mean, it's like, what's he actually doing in this chapter? He's groaning about how he's hungry, but, I mean, in this case, well, none of them have probably eaten for, like, 2 or 3 days, and, I mean, he's a hobbit, mm-hmm. so he's even hungrier than everybody else. So it's like, well, I don't actually blame him on that one. This is just me personally, but I don't blame him on that one. And then mm-hmm. we get to the point where they're all climbing up the trees, and it's like, oh, he can't reach it. It's like... Well, I mean, he's short, you know, that's just a physical disability there. What's he going to do on that one? I don't actually.
Yeah.
Whereas, so I don't know. So I don't actually, those aren't really knocks against his character or himself. Whereas I feel like I would naturally, if this were the first 4 chapters, I would just be like, Bilbo, what are you doing? You're so useless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's more like, even though we were saying he feels like dead weight, maybe it's more that he still kind of has tag-along status because of everything leading up to now. And even though he might be improving himself in the eyes of the dwarves, he hasn't quite reached the level where he's really getting the same treatment and respect.
Yeah.
You know, like he's still having to hang on to the other guy's ankles on the eagle flight.
Right.
And he's still having to scramble up the tree. Like he's still the tag-along. So he might have more respect now, but he hasn't. He's not actually functioning as a part of the group in the same way yet.
Yeah, but I also think, you know, when they see that he can't get up the tree, even the dwarves are like, oh, well, you know, he can't reach it. How about somebody go down and help him? It's not like, oh, great, we got to send somebody down to help him. They're like, no, just help him out, you know?
Right. So... Wargs. We got another creature on our hands. As always, who are they? What are they? What do we know about them? What motivates them?
So we'll do some philology here, because it was in one of Tom Shippey's books. So.
Okay.
All right, let's hit it. So, warg, it's a combination of 2 words. Actually, maybe 3. So the first word is from Old Norse. We know who Norse are. Like, they live in, like, you know, the Sweden... Norway area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So varg means wolf to them, but that wasn't actually the common Norse word for wolf. And then it's also, there's the Old English word were, which means outcast or outlaw, like a human outcast or outlaw. And then we also have the Old English verb a wargen, okay, which means to condemn or strangle or even possibly to bite to death. So if you mash all those together and you simplify it, you get warg, which is the wolves here. I mean, they're just giant wolves.
Okay.
So Shippey was kind of, Tom Shippey, the author of these books, was kind of saying maybe that possibly reflects that obviously they're wolves, but then they have intelligence about them with like that outcast or outlaw. Maybe it's like the lone, lone wolf kind of thing is what I was maybe thinking.
Well, I noticed looking into the background of some of these words that even without blending anything, just in the kind of the Old Norse turning into the Scandinavian languages, that vein of language, in modern Swedish, the word for wolf is varg. So in Germanic languages, V and W are kind of interchangeable.
Yeah.
So it's effectively the same word as just saying wolf in Swedish and other Scandinavian languages. But the roots of that come from wolf. It means wolf, but it also relates to destroy.
Yeah.
And like basically kind of evil.
Nice.
Is tied up with wolf.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing. Like Tolkien's not deliberately making the association here. Like there's already an established connection in the language between these kind of like dangerous, destructive beasts and the word for wolf.
Yeah. Cool. And I think that matches the book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the little bit that we know. Because, again, like, the goblins, we didn't get a super great description. I mean, we kind of just had to work off, like, other sources almost, I think, too. But, and so, I don't know. So what do we got for the wolves or the wargs in this book?
Things that I noticed, well, they get mentioned as wolves a few times, I think. They're described in pretty scary terms, but that's tempered by the fact that the tired and hungry dwarves and Bilbo are probably going to be scared of anything.
Yeah.
They seem pretty coordinated. The sounds are terrible, which is a little bit like the description for the goblins. and they're allied with the goblins, and they have some organization, but they sound like they're a little bit more like natural, irrational, unpredictable than goblins are. Like, goblins feel pretty dedicated to like creating evil and chaos in the world, and the wolves seem like, I don't know, they're not quite as evil, but they are they're definitely dangerous and strong.
Right. I mean, they were so, like, just for the context of the book too, the wolves weren't looking for the dwarves and Gandalf and Bilbo. Gandalf, the dwarves, and Bilbo just happened to be at the wolves' rallying point for where they were going to meet the goblins to go on some raid.
And I remember a little detail that he happened to mention that the wolves were under the impression that the dwarves and Bilbo and Gandalf were spies sent by the men whom they were going to raid later in the night. And so they assumed that their enemy had walked right into their trap.
Interesting.
And of course, even though Gandalf can understand them, they had no one in the group had any way to communicate with the wolves and say, hey, no, we're not the ones you're looking for.
Like you were saying, though, they are more, I'd say, bestial than the goblins. Like, I think that's okay. I think that's what you're going to hit there.
Yeah.
Which, well, that's kind of obvious. I mean, if you look at them, if you read the chapter, I mean, they're more of an animal than, you know, they don't stand on, like, two legs. They're like a, and they're related to wolves, which, I mean, we just usually think of as, like, wolves and dogs or something like that, or, like, the definition of animals, right? But, I mean, if we compare it to other mythologies, the example that first came to mind was kind of, like, centaurs.
Okay.
Whether that's...
Was that?
Well, whether that's, like, Greek mythology or Narnia or even, like, Harry Potter, and those, they're very wise and they're...
Centaurs are.
Yeah, tempered or temperate, kind of.
Tempered.
Yeah, I mean... Or measured, I don't know, something like that. Mm-hmm. They're not like wild beasts.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look in this story too, even the eagles, I mean, well, they're beasts, I'd say, you know, magical beasts, but I mean, they're beasts nonetheless. It's not like it's not like the standing on two legs kind of intelligent beings that we're used to in mythology or even science fiction.
So I'm curious, what do the eagles and the wargs have to do with each other? Because I was interested because they're introduced around the same time. And on the one hand, it's just like, oh, animals. It's part of the story. But both of them are clearly like, they're much more powerful and coordinated and knowledgeable than just animals out in the wild. Like, this is like a race of kind of giant magical creatures.
Well, I think that's kind of the nature of the beast with fantasy writing. I mean, you're going to get stuff like this where animals can talk.
Mm-hmm.
The eagles, I can tell you a whole backstory, and actually will later in this episode. But the only connection I really see between the two of them is, yeah, they can talk, and they're bigger than real life. I mean, you know, you got that impression right here from both of them.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't know. I think just the question of why they're bigger is actually kind of interesting. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I had no idea. I was surprised. My one thought is just, like you said, it's the nature of fantasy writing that they have to be magical, and therefore they got to be kind of epic, and making them big makes them epic.
Right. So I was thinking that same thing, as in bigger is badder in the case of the wargs, and bigger is majestic in the case of the eagles.
Yeah. I think the goblins being able to ride the wargs like horses was a pretty cool detail, but it also, for that to be the case, it necessitates that the wargs be pretty big.
Right. I think that's a cool detail, but that almost means like, what, you're gonna let something ride you? That makes you, again, that like goes back to like kind of the bestial level kind of thing, like more animal than intelligent being, like what,
right?
You're gonna... Yeah. But anyways, the other thing I was thinking, though, is maybe, you know, I mean, the story is placed older. Can we really tell what time period it's supposed to be for our world? You're not supposed to be able to tell. And as we've seen just already, it mixes and mashes a bunch of time periods. But I think you get a sense if you read any sort of mythology, and if you actually look at literally evolutionary history in real life, animals were bigger longer ago. Like, if you go to 10,000 BC, there were huge saber-toothed tigers and woolly mammoths, and like in Game of Thrones, you know, like the direwolves, like those were a literal real thing. There were direwolves that were huge. So
it's pretty sweet.
Yeah. So I mean, if you find the more ancient you go, the bigger they are, it makes it for a better story. Plus, you know, you're finding bones of these kinds of things maybe when people are writing these stories.
Okay. So it lends like an ancient quality to the story.
That's my guess. I don't really have a good answer.
So you promised you were going to tell us about the eagles. This is another exciting race. What do we know about them? Where do they come from? What makes them cooler than the wargs?
You think they're cooler than the wargs?
No, but I mean, they're good.
Well,
the wargs are bad.
I think they're cooler.
Okay. Well, so what makes them cooler?
All right. Well, I don't know. We somewhat have a slight system of, let's talk about what we know from the book, first of all. So start with a just completely abrupt and random introduction from the Lord of Eagles is basically just either sitting on a mountaintop or flying around doing like a regular kind of patrol or stroll around the sky kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Lord of Eagles himself, I'll say this right now, is extremely old.
What does extremely old mean? Gandalf is extremely old, right?
Yeah, Gandalf's a different case. I'm not tackling that yet. We are.
All right.
We're only at chapter 6 of The Hobbit, dude. We're not ready to deal with the metaphysics of Gandalf.
Okay, that's fine.
But anyways, we're talking thousands of years.
So is he older than Elrond?
Based on knowledge that I know, yes, he is.
Okay.
Anyways, though, so he's just flying around doing a routine patrol, and then, you know, we're hearing that the eagle's typical job is if they see goblins hatching some sort of evil plot or whatever, they just mess it up. Just rule of thumb. Eagles mess up goblins.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think we're always saying eagles kind of good guys, goblins obviously the standard bad guy.
Okay.
And so yeah, just if good guys see something happening, they mess up the bad guys. We also learn at the very end of the chapter that Gandalf actually healed the Lord of Eagles when he had an arrow wound at one point. So I think it makes sense.
There's an owed debt there.
Yeah, so it makes sense that when the eagles, you know, use their great vision and see that Gandalf himself is in trouble, then they're definitely like, oh, yeah, we got to jump in, step in here and help out. What I don't like about this chapter, and at some point we'll talk about this, but I don't think Tolkien himself even liked it, you know, in later years. But I just thought it was the dumbest thing ever when they said the eagles steal men's sheep. I mean, it's like, okay, yeah, they gotta eat. Okay, I get that part. And yeah, he mostly just wrote it as kind of like a clever little joke. But I mean, it's just, we're talking about a very old and noble race of beings. And besides that line, we get that these guys are pretty good guys, good guys throughout this whole thing. And then it's
you're saying they're above that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, that's like a throwaway stupid line that puts their, I don't know, their whole race's integrity into question, in my opinion.
So I read that was Tolkien trying to make sure that they have a balance of positive and negative, so that they feel more neutral.
Well, all right, so you know what? So we're going to do a big break here into some Middle Earth history. I don't know if people like this. If people like this, you know, send us some emails whether you actually like this stuff or not. It's kind of a spoiler, but I think it adds to the depth of the podcast, and you know, you actually see what else is going on. Of course, maybe it doesn't actually fit with The Hobbit, because none of this would have actually applied, because originally this story wasn't supposed to be part of Middle Earth. But let's get into where the eagles actually come from, their first appearance in Middle Earth ever.
So is it, you're pulling from the Silmarillion here?
We are indeed pulling from the Silmarillion. So I'm going to ask you some recap questions just to, you know, fit the context. Last time we talked about the Silmarillion was in chapter 3 when we were talking about the elves. And we talked about Elrond's family, or generations above Elrond, who like fought at the Battle of Gondolin. Everybody remember
that? A long time ago.
It was a long, long time ago. I agreed. All right, so you remember, do you remember the Valar, Clifford? They live in Valinor?
I do. So the Valar, from what I remember, are this sort of league of archangels, sort of. They're like demigods, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's one head god. There's one head god who's not it doesn't seem like he's very involved, kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay.
And the Valar kind of act like the Greek gods.
Okay. Yeah. So they're for all intents and purposes, they're kind of the gods in this situation.
Yeah, but we'll just call them the Valar just to keep it kind of simple.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because they're sort of personified also, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so the Valar live in Valinor, which is, if you've seen a map of Middle Earth, there's a huge sea to the west of it. Mm-hmm. If you go all the way across that sea, there's a sliver of land in the west, and that's Valinor. And that's
where I gave my analogy last time, but if you think of Middle Earth being the United States, Valinor is Japan.
What? That's your analogy?
Yeah, dude.
No, dude. Middle Earth
is
Europe.
It makes so much sense.
No, Middle Earth is Europe, and and Valinor is the east coast of the U.S.
Obviously, I'm just telling you, my analogy makes a lot of sense.
Mine just made more sense, and it was the same thing, except more accurate, because Middle Earth is definitely based off of Europe.
Culturally, appearance-wise, absolutely. But the geography, I think, is more... Okay, anyways, let's keep going.
Okay, all right. So, Valinor, if you remember, it was lighted by two trees. One was like, it gave out silver light, one gave out golden light, and then their light was preserved in the Silmarils. Remember that? That's where the Silmarilling gets its name.
They're two gems, right? That one of the elves who's a master craftsman makes?
The Silmarils are three gems, but yes.
Three gems, my apologies.
And that elf?
But they're crafted by one of the elves.
Yeah, what's his name?
Fëanor?
Nice, Clifford, nice. All
right. Yeah.
You remember the biggest badass of the Silmarillion.
Yes.
All right. So now we remember that the two trees get destroyed and the Silmarils are stolen by Melkor, who's just the ultimate evil bad guy.
He's one of the Valar, right?
He's actually more powerful than any of them, so he should be a Valar, but since he's a bad guy, they just don't count him. But yeah.
Okay, so he's kind of he's at the level of the Valar, but he's not.
Yeah, just think of like Satan or Lucifer. He's literally the equivalent kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Hades in Hercules, maybe.
Yeah. 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 All right. Sure. So then, now Fëanor, who made the Silmarils, as Clifford noted, he leads a group of his people, which is like about a third of the elves, which is the Noldor. We remember them.
Uh huh.
They go back, they leave Valinor without the god's blessing, and then eventually, because of events that happen, they are even cursed by, when I say the gods, I mean by the Valar, and they return to Middle-earth. You remember that part?
Uh-huh.
I think I'm just brushing through all this. There's, like, just so much more going on. Maybe eventually we'll hit it. I don't know if I found a place yet in these shows for it. But anyways, Fëanor goes back to Middle-earth. And when he originally gets to Middle-earth, he only actually has half his army because he personally ditched the second half because he's an interesting character.
Yeah, it's pretty harsh.
Yeah, we don't have time to get into it, but anyways, so they're fighting. Fëanor's half of the army is fighting, battling, and everything like that. And then Fëanor's oldest son, Methros, gets ambushed and he's captured by Melkor, who's the big evil guy, and he's got a huge
fighting.
Yeah, and he's got a huge fortress set up at the north of Middle Earth.
Okay.
So this fortress is basically three huge volcanoes at the beginning of this huge mountain range that's in the north of Middle Earth.
Uh-huh.
And within that there's like thousands and thousands and thousands of tunnels beneath it where the real fort is. So, anyways, he captures Methros, Fëanor's oldest son, and he ties him by one wrist. He's just dangling over, like a huge precipice where, he's just hanging there by the mm-hmm. wrist, locked in like some iron handcuff thing, and so that's like basically part of his torment. Maybe the orcs like poke him or throw stuff. Goblins throw stuff at him. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But anyways, after the two trees are destroyed, the Valar, back in Valinor, using what's left of the two destroyed trees, they actually have enough power to create the sun and the moon. And they set them up out in the sky so that they can be a light not just to Valinor, but to all of Middle-earth as well. So they'll actually go across the sky each day.
Interesting.
Right. So before this, Middle-earth was in complete darkness. It only had starlight to light it up. But now they have the sun and moon. So when the sun comes out, the orcs don't like it. because they're not used to it. That kind of just orcs. When I say orcs, I mean goblins too. Sorry, we'll get into that at some point. What's the difference?
Okay.
Yeah. So the goblins don't like it. So they hide in all their tunnels. Now, eventually, the second half of Fëanor's army, led by his half brother Fingolfin, shows up, and they're pissed off at the other first half, Fëanor's army, for abandoning them.
Uh-huh.
Again, great story, super epic, but this isn't the scope to cover that right now.
Okay. Anyways, Fingolfin's half of the army shows up.
Yeah.
Fëanor's son is in captivity.
Right. And so now the two halves of the armies are kind of pissed at each other, but Fingolfin's oldest son, Fingon, so this means he's first cousins with Methros, is all like, oh man, Methros, he was my best friend as a kid. And, you mm-hmm. know, our families are kind of feuding right now. You know what? I'm going to heal this divide, and I'm going to be pretty bold here, but I'm going to walk in and save Methros. So that's what he does. He goes up to Morgoth's fortress, and now, so he gets away with, like, pretty lucky here because all the orcs are hiding.
Wait, Morgoth. Who's Morgoth?
Morgoth is the equivalent. Same thing as Melkor. They just give him a different name because they hate to say the word Melkor.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So he goes into his fortress, those three volcano things, and now all the orcs are hiding underground. And so because they don't like the sunlight. Now Melkor mm-hmm. is also, because he sees the sunlight, he's starting to pump smoke. He's starting to pump smoke or pollution or whatever out of the volcano so they can create basically cloud cover from the sun.
Total. Maintain the darkness.
Yeah, but that just only helps Fingon climb higher into the mountains without being seen just because he's within the smoke. Yeah, it is very interesting. So anyways, though, Fingon's walking around and he's bold enough that he literally took a harp with him and he's playing a song that all the Noldor would have known from their childhood. And that might just be like something so that he can get Methros' attention to actually find him because this is a big place and he's like wandering around and he's lost.
Okay, but he's playing music behind enemy lines.
Yeah, so I think this would be a good time to show the contrast between the layman's explanation that I've been giving here this whole time and just reveal some of the epic language that is the entirety of the Silmarillion.
All right, I'm ready.
All right, so we're taking up the story. I'm just going to read like a paragraph of it from where we're at right now. Okay. Thus Fingon found what he sought, for suddenly above him, far and faint, his song was taken up, and a voice answering called to him. Methros it was that sang amid his torment, but Fingon climbed to the foot of the precipice where his kinsmen hung, and then could go no further, and he wept when he saw the cruel device of Morgoth. Methros, therefore, being in anguish without hope, begged Fingon to shoot him with his bow, and Fingon strung an arrow and bent his bow. And seeing no better hope, he cried to Manwë, saying, O king to whom all birds are dear, speed now this feathered shaft, and recall some pity for the Noldor in their need. His prayer was swiftly answered, for Manwë, to whom all birds are dear, had sent forth the race of eagles, commanding them to dwell in the crags of the north. For Manwë still had pity for the exiled elves. Now, even as Fingon bent his bow, there flew down from the high airs Thrandor, king of the eagles, mightiest of all birds that has ever been, whose outstretched wings span 30 fathoms.
30 fathoms?
30 fathoms. So I looked it up. A fathom is 6 feet.
Holy cow. So 180 feet. It's like the size of an airplane.
Is that the size of an airplane?
Yeah, let me get you a quick reference for that. So that's like twice as wide as a Boeing 737. I'm saying like he's twice the size of an airplane.
Oh, man.
That's a big bird.
That is pretty big. That's pretty cool. Pretty cool. Yeah. All right. So Manwë, you know, just so that you're not lost in these references, Manwë is they're saying he's like lord of all birds and everything like that. And so he's actually the head of the Valar. I might have mentioned that last time, I'm not sure. But if he's the head of Valar and, you know, he's kind of like the sky god kind of thing, he's the equivalent of Zeus, I'd say.
Okay.
Just for references there. And then, like we said, the Noldor, that's this people, they left Valinor without the blessing of the gods. And literally by the end of it, they were cursed by the gods. So that's what he's talking about. Like, he still had pity for the exiled elves.
Okay.
But yeah, like we said, though, this guy, Throndor, whose wingspan is twice the size of a Boeing airplane.
Okay, so I looked it up. I have a better reference. 747, the really big one.
Yeah.
He's smaller than that.
Okay. Well, fair enough if you can get close to that thing.
Yeah, but that's pretty darn close.
So he's there, and he swoops in, and Finnegan's about to shoot Methros, but instead, obviously, he hops on the eagle's back. They fly up to Methros, and so then they're trying to get him out of this handcuff thing that he's cuffed to the mountain by, and they're like, oh, man, it's like super great iron, you know, it's probably some sort of magical spell on it or something, whatever. They can't, like, release him, whatever. And so Methros is like, oh, dude, do not leave me here. Like, just finish me now if I can't get out of this. So instead of doing that, Finnegan just cuts off Methros' hand, and they both land on the eagle, and they fly away. Now, they fly away. Finnegan is a massive hero to all of the families of the Noldor, and the feud between the two families is healed. So that's just kind of the story there of the Silmarillion. You know, I'm just gonna send out like all sorts of feeler stories like this. Just like, hey, you should pick up the Silmarillion and read it.
Mm-hmm. But also, we're helping break it down and tie it into the rest of this.
Right. So first of all, I'd like to say that Throndor, this king of the eagles, he would have been a personal friend of the Lord of Eagles that's in The Hobbit here. So the Lord of Eagles would have known him personally. The gap between these two stories is 6,500 years. So we're okay. Talking, you know, the Lord of the Eagles is over 6,500 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. So when I said old, I meant old.
No kidding.
Now, another thing to point out, let's see. So, you know, Middle Earth was originally made, and there were all sorts of creatures there and everything like that. We haven't met, mm-hmm. Close to any of the creatures, any of the memorable creatures yet. We won't fully meet all of them until like probably the end of the Lord of the Rings, I'd say. But the eagles were not originally part of Middle Earth. They were sent at this time
by Manwë.
By Manwë from Valinor.
Okay. So they interesting.
So if they ever seem kind of passive throughout these books or anything like that, this kind of goes back to reason for that.
Okay. So it's like they're kind of it's as though they're with the gods or of the gods in a way that a lot of these other characters aren't.
Yeah, I mean they literally are not from here, kind of thing.
Uh-huh. But it's like an arm of the gods almost reaching into the story.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, yeah, like it, I mean it's kind of in their nature to kind of swoop in.
Okay.
So I'm gonna preemptively just start laying the groundwork here. If you read this chapter, it seems pretty routine that the eagles were just doing like some kind of patrol, and then they see that people who they associate as good guys are kind of in trouble, so they go to save them. Mm-hmm. I think it's totally believable, you know, like, I think in the movie it was kind of random that they just came and swooped in out of nowhere, but, I mean, it seems, if you read this chapter, that just seems legit to me. That's fine. That's an easy way to introduce another race kind of thing. Now,
okay.
At some point, the eagles, you might get the idea that, oh, they're just a convenient plot tool to save everybody from danger kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they just show up right at the last minute, save them before Gandalf is about to throw himself into the flames. And
yeah, so now we can't finish the conversation here because this is the only example we have. But if you just take that view strictly, I would say personally, I think that's pretty pessimistic. From the very beginning of when they were originally came to Middle-earth, they've had that quality that they do actually literally swoop in and save the day kind of thing. And there's more to it from a storytelling perspective, and there's more to it in like Tolkien's life himself and in just general life overall, mm-hmm. I'd say.
So, right before the eagles swoop in, when they're stuck up in the trees, Gandalf is all the way up the top of the trees. He's throwing flames down, and he's about to jump into the middle of the wargs and the goblins. And Tolkien says that would have been the end of him. Like, Gandalf was about to die going into this random battle. It doesn't seem quite like him to me. Like, he's always very wise and powerful and very calm and on top of things. And we don't really know what the limits to his power are. Like, I don't totally understand how he can do what he can do. And other times he's kind of very passive. But it just seemed like he was way more desperate here than I expected, rather.
All right, so a couple things. First of all, just a side note. When he's throwing down those pine cones on fire, just like the touch that some of the fire is like red or green or blue, I thought that was cool detail.
Yeah, it's like fireworks.
To me, that's just the classic throwaway token detail that's just iconic and awesome. And sure, other fantasy writers, they probably have similar stuff, but I don't think anybody can throw it up just so easily as Tolkien does throughout all of these books. I don't know. Side note, you know, we could take issue, we could talk about that later. But I don't think that fits in with Gandalf's character either. Like, him actually being scared. I guess scared is like, okay, that shows he's like vulnerable, you know, he's like I'm not gonna say he's human. I mean, it shows like some sort of human side, I'd say. But yeah, I didn't think it fits with his overall character. I think it fits with the situation that the Eagles need to save him more so. And right. Of course,
like the intense desperation where this like over this kind of outside force would come in.
And I guess it could fit with his character so far in The Hobbit. If you look at his character in Lord of the Rings, whether that's just the movies or if you've read the books already, yeah, I don't think that fits at all. And I think that's something Tolkien would end up regretting, because this will be a conversation at some point. But Tolkien, I think he ends up regretting how he narrates The Hobbit here. Like, it works. It functionally works as a book. But when you compare it to Lord of the Rings and the rest of the mythology, it's just some parts of it are just kind of dumb. Now, I would also say, too, though, Gandalf organized this whole trip, like this whole trip to the Lonely Mountain. This is like basically his doing. So he's not just going to let a bunch of guys get screwed up. If he has to give his life for it, maybe that's worth it. So if everybody else can escape, I would say.
Okay. I buy that. It still surprised me, but I get that.
Yeah, I don't think it fits perfectly. I mean, okay. That's all I can say on that.
I'd say that's it for my questions. It was an exciting chapter. I'm eager to see what happens next, where they go from the Eagle's Eyrie.
Yep. I'd say that's it for this episode, too. Why don't we just finish it off real quick here?
Okay.
All right, so I really wanted to literally today release the first episode. Everything's done. I just got to figure out how. That's probably going to come within the next couple days. When you're hearing this, hopefully I've already been out for like 4 or 5 weeks, but whatever. So we can't do any sort of reviews or give out a beer koozie to anybody. But anyways, just housekeeping stuff. Check out the website, talkingtolkienpodcast.com. What's the Instagram again?
Talking Tolkien Podcast.
Nice. Okay, the Twitter at Tolkien Talking. Facebook page. Hopefully that's created. Hopefully the episode's available at wherever you listen to podcasts. Like we just said, we don't have any reviews yet, but give us a review. And five star review. If it's witty and we read it out here, you're going to get Talking Tolkien Podcast Beer Koozie. Quite the coveted possession. Anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Yeah. All right, why don't we just end it here? We'll give you a quick one. Hopefully this was quick. I don't know.
I think it was.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's quicker than the last two, but yeah. All right, cool. Well, then, Clifford, you have a good week. Listeners, have a good week.
You as well, Patrick.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for doing this while you're tired, Clifford.
Of course. I've always got energy for The Hobbit.
Oh. All right.
Thanks, y'all.